A famous proverb says that time and tide wait for no man. Today, people typically use the proverb to refer to the failure to act when opportunity knocks. But the origin of the phrase lies in the powerlessness of man. The proverb can be traced back to Geoffrey Chaucer's prologue to The Clerk's Tale. Chaucer's proverb was inspired by King Canute, whose courtiers told him he was omnipotent. To demonstrate his impotence in the face of Mother Nature, King Canute took his men to the sea and commanded the tide to stop, with predictable results. Of course, a man can no more stop time than he can stop tide. When Willie Vesey was arrested in 1992, he was 26 years old. When I spoke with his sister Keitra about a month ago, it was Willie's 52nd birthday. He's now spent half of his life in prison, and his then 12-year-old sister is now a 37-year-old mother.
I just want my brother to come home, because he missed so much of not only my life, but my kids' life. You know, and it's hard to accept that when somebody's always been there for you, no matter what, whether it was good or bad. And as I was growing up, I used to say, no, my brother's going to walk through the door on Christmas. He's going to surprise us on New Year's or surprise me on my birthday. And what I get in the mail is a card from him. And I'm like, well, where's my brother?
At Willie Vesey's trial, the strongest evidence of his innocence was not a man, not even a human being. According to the prosecutor, you can put it on the witness stand and you can ask it questions until you're blue in the face. It will say nothing. This was true, but the prosecutor's argument could be both a blessing and a curse, because unlike its human counterpart, the evidence of Willie Vesey's innocence also couldn't lie, couldn't be motivated to protect him. And that left the prosecutor with one argument that amazingly worked. That Willie Vesey could turn back time, or at least cheat it.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Willie Vesey. This episode is The Alibi. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleagues, as always, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog occasionally at The View from LL2.
In the last two episodes, we laid out all of the evidence the state presented against Willie Vesey at trial. First, Denise Mitchell picked him out of a photo array months after failing to identify him when she was first shown the same array. Second, when the police apprehension team arrived at his row house at about 6 a.m. in the morning, he supposedly tried to hide in a bathtub. And third, when taken to the police station, he initially agreed that he had taken part in the robbery of Ephraim Gonzalez. In response, the defense team presented two types of evidence. The first is character evidence. Now, character evidence isn't admissible in civil cases such as those involving contract disputes. The thinking is that we want jurors deciding cases based upon evidence of the dispute at hand and not based on whether they judge the parties to be good or bad people. But the law gives a special dispensation to a criminal defendant to present character evidence because his liberty and sometimes even his life is at stake. For Willie Vesey, it was the latter. Here's his trial attorney, Jules Epstein.
Tried as a capital case, because back then every case in Philadelphia where it was possible to proceed capitally, proceeded capitally, which means we had a death-qualified jury. I'm not using that as an excuse, simply as a descriptor to say, needless to say, attacking police credibility is even harder with a death-qualified jury, at least back then in Philadelphia.
And so, Epstein set out to locate character witnesses for his client.
And I spent some time meeting Willie's family. I was in his home. Nice people. And they were able to get me neighbors and acquaintances to come in.
As any defense attorney will tell you, this was the exception rather than the rule. That's because character evidence at a criminal trial is a Pandora's box. If the defendant keeps it closed, no character evidence will be heard by the jury, but if he opens it to present good character evidence, the prosecution gets to respond in kind.
Lawyers only called character witnesses if their clients had no convictions.
Quite simply, prior convictions are poison for criminal defendants and likely to kill an otherwise strong case of innocence. But Willie didn't have a criminal record. A defendant's good character evidence can also tank his case if it's followed by the prosecutor calling witnesses who then attack the character of the defendant or the character of his witnesses. But in this case,
there wasn't much to impeach Willie's character witnesses with, so this was a safe bet.
Character evidence can be compelling, which is reflected by the fact that defendants presenting good character evidence in Pennsylvania can get a pretty powerful jury instruction at the close of their cases.
And you actually get a jury instruction that says that's how you should weigh this, and you, the jury, if you choose, may use that alone as a ground for saying the government has not proved its case beyond a reasonable doubt.
And so the defense presented a parade of character witnesses at trial. Willie's mother, his stepfather, his supervisors at work, a man who owned the car repair shop down the street, the awesomely named Ella Handsome who lived five doors down, Willie's 72-year-old neighbor, another neighbor whom had known Willie for 17 years, and yet another neighbor who had known him for 20 years. Given how long these people knew Willie Vesey, you might expect that they went into detail about what they knew about Willie and why they believed he was incapable of taking part in a robbery or especially a murder. Instead, their testimony all looked like the testimony given by Vertel Whiting, the neighbor who had known Willie for 20 years. Question, Ms. Whiting, do you know my client Willie Vesey?
Yes, I do.
Question, how long have you known him, ma'am?
For about 20 years.
Question, do you know other people who that also knew him?
Yes, I do.
Question, amongst those other people that also know Willie Vesey, what is his reputation for being a peaceful and law-abiding citizen?
Excellent.
This seems odd, right? Rather than being asked what she thinks of Willie based on knowing him for 20 years, Whiting is being asked about what other people thought about him. And as Ella Handsome noted during cross-examination, I don't usually have conversations with people about who is law-abiding and who isn't. So her testimony probably wasn't worth much. So what's going on here?
There are things in life you just have to take care of, no matter how unpleasant and tedious they may be. And yes, I'm talking about taxes, but not just taxes. I'm also talking about insurance policies. Because life insurance and other kinds of insurance, well, they're just not the most fun things in the world to talk about, but they're really important. So this is the part of the podcast where we talk about life insurance. Don't go hitting mute yet, because this is even more important than it is tedious, like I said before. But guess what? There's an easier way now. At PolicyGenius.com. PolicyGenius.com is the place to go to learn about life insurance, compare quotes from America's top providers, and save up to 40% on your policy. It sounds crazy, but guess what? That's actually never existed before. They've placed over $5 billion in life insurance, and PolicyGenius' simple, user-friendly website helps you work out exactly which policy is right for you and find you the best price, and it only takes 5 minutes to apply for a quote. Now, most Americans think that life insurance costs 2 to 3 times more than it actually does. And if you're one of them, you stand to save more than you think. If you have any questions, Policy Genius has a team of licensed experts waiting to talk you through it. No call waiting, no pressing 3 followed by the pound sign. You get actual customer service. And they don't only do life insurance. You can get health insurance, insure your pet, protect your income, renter's insurance. And if you don't need to do any of that, well, they'll tell you. So if you've been putting off getting life insurance and you want to make sure the insurance you have is right for you, check out PolicyGenius.com today. You can save up to 40% just by comparison policies. The quotes are free. There is no sales pressure and zero hassle. PolicyGenius.com. It's life insurance for the 21st century.
In 2009, the Supreme Court of Illinois decided to codify rules of evidence that had previously only existed in case law. My task was to compare each Illinois evidentiary principle with the corresponding rule of evidence in other states across the country and give a recommendation about whether to stick with the Illinois approach or change the national approach in the case of a conflict. One area of deviation involved character evidence. Federal Rule of Evidence 405A says that when character evidence is admissible, it can be proven through opinion or reputation evidence. The same held true in 48 other states. The exceptions were Illinois and Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania rule dates back to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania's 1817 opinion in Kimmel versus Kimmel, where the court found that a witness who had known a party for 20 years couldn't offer his opinion about his bad character. According to the court,
opinions will not be evidence, for if it were, no witness would be saved from the shafts of calumny. No man is to be discredited by the mere opinion of another. Few men live whom some do not think ill of. But it is said the witness must speak of his own knowledge, so he must. But what is this knowledge? Not a personal, individual knowledge of facts. He knows, by reputation, what is the character of the man.
Yeah, so this seemed like a pretty terrible idea to me, because essentially it allows for a character witness to testify about community gossip about people while precluding them from testifying as to what they've seen with their own two eyes. So I recommend that Illinois change the national approach, and the Supreme Court of Illinois agreed. Illinois now allows for character witnesses to give opinion evidence about good character. So that means that Pennsylvania now stands alone in the country in precluding character witnesses from offering their own opinions. And in most cases, that distinction probably doesn't matter, because character evidence is like all those letters of recommendation sent every day saying that a candidate is just as good and accomplished as anyone else. This case is different, though. Over the last few years, we've talked with a lot of attorneys about possible cases for the podcast, and they've all said why they think that the wrong man was convicted. But the way that Willie's attorneys talk about him are like those rare letters of recommendation that make you do a double take. Here's Marissa and Jim from the Pennsylvania Innocence Project.
Willie's the kind of man who, when he walks into a room, you know it. He just has a terrific presence about him. He carries himself almost regally. He has a very gentle nature about him. He is earnest and thoughtful. He's a marvelous artist. We actually have quite a little war going on in our office over his artwork, because I refuse to bring it from home to the office where it's supposed to be, but I like it where it is. And so he has just such a really gentle aura about him. He is engaging, he is intelligent, he is thoughtful. And yet there's always something inside of him which is, you know, almost innocent, despite everything that he's been through. He still has this kind of core of just a truly innocent, I don't mean that in the legal sense, but just of just innocence about him, even despite everything. And it is really, you just come away from him thinking, wow, you know, that's somebody I'm glad I met, and I'm glad that I know him. He has a very different presence than many of the people that we come into contact regularly.
Mm-hmm. He's a very nice guy. I would describe him as just a nice man. He's very charismatic, and he has no rough edges about him that you would expect to have after 25 years in prison, in a maximum security prison. The man is just, he's kindness, he's very nice, he's quiet. I actually found him a pleasure to be around.
And here's his trial attorney, Jules Epstein.
So I don't want to say something silly like impossible for him to be a murderer, because I'm good, but I'm not that good. But he was not a hard guy. I've represented mafioso and gang members and repeat murderers, and they all have some humanity also, but there's an edge to them. There was no edge to Willie Vesey. Willie was the nice guy, a soft-voiced guy, you know, the guy who worked as a dishwasher.
Epstein's answer gives us the transition to the second kind of evidence presented by the defense in Willie Vesey's case, alibi evidence. As Epstein notes, Willie Vesey worked as a dishwasher at the Houlihan's restaurant in Jenkintown, which was 7.8 miles due north of the location where the Jamaican was shot. Many of the people who worked in the kitchen, including Willie Vesey, lived in North Philadelphia and would take the 55 bus to and from work. We spoke with Mr. Seth Schramm, who was the back-of-the-house manager at the Houlihan's in 1992 and is now a high school principal.
From what you recall, what was the situation in terms of employees clocking in and clocking out back in 1992?
Well, we had a time clock, and the employees would clock in and clock out, and then sometimes we'd ask them to stay late. If we did, then we would adjust the time card manually. It was kind of, you know, a long time ago. Different type of no technology was there.
At trial, the front-of-the-house manager, Susan Myers, testified that Willie Veazey didn't have a car and relied on the bus to get to and from work. One night, he worked so late that he missed the final bus and she had to drive him home. Here's what she remembered when we spoke to her recently.
I also gave him a ride home one night, and not to the greatest part of Philadelphia, mind you. And I would never do that for anyone that I had any inkling or hesitation or, you know what I mean? To drive someone home at, you know, 1:30 in the morning down to that neck of the woods meant that I trusted him.
Now, the fact that Willie didn't have a car is significant in and of itself, because you might recall that Denise Mitchell said that Willie shot Ephraim Gonzalez after getting out of a red car that she had seen him drive before. The fact that Willie didn't own a car and relied on the bus to get to and from work stands in stark contrast to her claim. Willie's trial attorney also thinks that Willie's job narrative provided a pretty strong rebuke to the narrative presented by the prosecution at trial.
So here's a guy who lives in North Philadelphia. For people who don't know Philadelphia, that's the inner city then and probably now, a primarily low to modest income and significantly, if not entirely, African-American area. And this is a guy who had to travel about 8 miles. There's a bus. I assume that's how he went. I never asked. To go out to this job of washing dishes. And the guy was working regularly. This was not the paradigm of somebody out on the streets and hustling and trying to be the bad guy. It's the guy who washed the dishes.
Of course, all of this is important, but it's also just prologue to one of the strongest alibis you're ever likely to see in the case of a man who was convicted. Let's start by reorienting ourselves with the timeline. The Jamaican and Ephraim Gonzalez were shot on Friday, January 24th, 1992, shortly before 10 p.m. Specifically, a series of 911 calls about the shooting started at 9:51 and 53 seconds. Now, this takes us to the piece of evidence that the prosecutor said you could put on the witness stand and ask questions until you were blue in the face, but you wouldn't get a response. A time card. Specifically, Willie Veazey's time card for the Houlihans. That time card showed that he had punched in at 5:59 p.m. on January 24th, 1992, and punched out at either 1:52 or 1:54 a.m. on January 25th, the next day, about 4 hours after the Jamaican was murdered. These times were punched on the time card by the time clock. The 5:59 check-in time was crossed out and replaced by a handwritten 6 p.m. And the 1:52 or 1:54 time was also crossed out and replaced by a handwritten 1:50 a.m. Next to these changes were the initials SM for Susan Myers. Colin asked Myers about these changes.
So the time card shows on the front end, he checked in at 5:59 p.m. and you had crossed that out and replaced it with 6 o'clock p.m. And you remember why you would have done that?
Well, you're not supposed to punch in early. So that would have been why. He would have been due in at 6 and he punched in a minute early. And this is why they called me Sergeant Susan. and at the end of the night, the only reason I would change his punch out time is if he punched out after he changed his clothes. So, you know, I would not have changed it unless there was something visibly that I saw that he did that made him punch out late. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, the time card showed he punched out. It was either 1:52 or 1:54 a.m., and you corrected that to 1:50. And from what you're saying here and during trial, right, that would be something where you actually saw him having changed his clothes or used the bathroom, and that's why
exactly.
that night you would have made that correction.
Exactly. Yes, we make our corrections that night. We go through the time cards, and I would only have made it if I had personally seen him do something that would cause me to change it. Mm-hmm. The punch in one would just be because he was due at 6 and he didn't punch in at 6. He punched in at, or whatever. But the one leaving, definitely, he was there. I know he was there.
Quite simply, this is tremendously important. One of the key narratives that the prosecution wanted to present at trial was that Willie never went to work on January 24th and instead had someone punch in and out for him. Now, this would seemingly be the only narrative that could cohere with the version of events given by Willie in his confession, which, if you recall, is that he was playing basketball by his house when Lindell picked him up for the robbery. But what Myers is saying is that her change to Willie's punch-out time means that she must have seen him clocking out after he changed and or used the bathroom, which is why she docked him 2 or 4 minutes from his punch-out time. So the narrative that Willie never went to work that night doesn't hold any water. This is important because Willie wasn't arrested until 4.5 months after the Jamaican was murdered, so no one from the Houlihans could specifically remember whether Willie was there on the night of January 24th. But Susan Myers' correction means that she did in fact see him that night, at least at punch-out time. So on the other hand, is it possible that Willie had someone else punch in for him and was able to slip into work after the murder undetected? Both Susan Myers and Seth Schramm find this highly unlikely. Here's Susan Myers.
You know, when people are coming in, you are seeing who's going to be on your shift. You're like, it's a Friday night or whatever, and you want to know that you have good people, so it's going to go smoothly. And you go around, you say hello to everybody, you're giving directions, you're getting them started, you know. I don't specifically know who is going to come in unless they don't show up. Then I'm like, why are we short? And then I find out, you know, look at the schedule.
And here's Seth Schramm.
First of all, the front of the house is being taken care of by the front of the house manager and or general manager. Back of the house is being taken care of by me and maybe an assistant chef. If you have somebody missing on a Friday night, you get them replaced. Or you have somebody else cover their duties because you're doing anywhere between 600 and 1,200 covers, which was the busiest night of the week often, that or Saturday. And, yeah, you could not go with a hole in it. If you did have a hole in it, you need to make sure that you kind of did some shifting around to make a change.
Now, in this case, there's no need to guess how many customers were served at the Jenkintown Houlihans on Friday, January 24th. The defense had Susan Myers bring in the restaurant's cost book, and it showed that 848 customers were served during the dinner shift that night, not including people who were seated at the bar. And both Susan Myers and Seth Schramm testified that there would have been 4 dishwashers scheduled to work that night, the minimum number needed based upon that volume of customers, which was typical for a Friday night. In other words, there's no way the dinner shift would have started without Willie being there. If they were a man down, they would have called someone else in. So, is a third possibility possible? Is it possible that Willie punched in and was able to slip out in the middle of his shift to commit the murder before returning undetected? Well, first, there's the question of timing. Here's Susan Myers.
What are the reasons specifically that you would say that there's no way he could have slipped out on this Friday night without being noticed for, say, an hour or an hour and a half?
Well, it would have taken him more than an hour and a half anyway to go down to Center City and do whatever he's accused of doing and then come back. Just with traffic and going from our Jenkintown location to where I guess it supposedly happened.
And then there's the matter of location. At trial, Susan Myers testified that she had an office that she would periodically enter and exit throughout the night. According to Myers, that office was only 6 feet away from the dishwashing station. She would have known if they were a man down for any significant period of time.
As a manager, I'm walking all over the place. I'm in the front of the restaurant, I'm in the back of the restaurant, I'm going back in the dish room. I'm seeing who's there. I know who's on shift, and I'm asking for help from certain people, and I just honestly, with all my heart and just as a manager, I just can't imagine that he wasn't there.
Meanwhile, here's Seth Schramm on the subject.
But as you said, especially on a busy Friday night where, from your testimony, there were 4 dishwashers who were scheduled, there's no way that one of those could have gone missing for any period of time.
No flipping way.
Right. And I think from your testimony as well, and it might have been Susan Myers' testimony, when we say that someone was a dishwasher, it doesn't mean that they were just washing dishes. They also had other responsibilities around the restaurant, right?
They first of all, they were stocking dishes on the food line where I was for a lot of the night. They were out in the waitress area. They were in the prep kitchen putting pots back there. They're all over the place. It's not like they're just back there and you don't see them.
Right.
Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using just your own computer and printer. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail based on your individual needs. There's no need to lease an expensive postage meter. You can create your Stamps.com account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. You just click, print, mail, and you're done. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes. You can print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7. Now, we were just putting together our schedule for 2018 for Undisclosed, and we're working on several different cases in several different states that we look forward to presenting to you. And Stamps.com has already made it so easy to get and receive information in those cases. And right now, you too can enjoy the Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus postage, and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Undisclosed. That's Stamps.com, enter Undisclosed. Stamps.com, never go to the post office again.
So given all this, how was the jury able to find this alibi defense didn't even raise reasonable doubt as to Willie Veazey's guilt? Let's break down the prosecutor's arguments point by point. First, no one, including Sharamma Myers, was able to testify that they specifically remembered seeing Willie Veazey at work on January 24th. That's true as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far. Because who would remember whether a specific employee was present on an average Friday night when they weren't asked until several months later? And Myers' testimony makes clear that she must have seen him at the end of the shift at about 1:50 a.m. on January 25th. And then there's point two. The time cards used to be kept in a box underneath the time clock, but they had since been moved to an office. The prosecutor wanted to know about the switch. But according to Myers, this move happened only because the box had become unattached from the wall and not because employees were abusing time procedures. She also testified that she was unaware of any time procedure abuse by employees. And that leads to point three. Willie could have tampered with the clock to create a fake alibi. This was a non-starter for Susan Myers. She testified that they calculate hours at the end of each shift by looking at the time cards and put them into the cost book, so there's no way that Willie could have created a false entry before or after the fact. Seth Schramm recalled something similar.
Yeah, that was, in reviewing the testimony, Susan Myers was, I guess, the front of the house manager, and your testimony is, yeah, at the end of the night, I reviewed the time cards with Myers. That's your recollection?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we would do a daily report on sales and all that other stuff, and we would do labor costs and all that, too. And then we would do weekly. So, yeah, we did check them every night.
Second, Myers noted that the time clock was very difficult to adjust and that adjustments could only be done by managers who had a key to the clock. In other words, Willie couldn't turn back time.
Point four, double punching. At trial, Susan Myers produced a bunch of time cards for various employees from Houlihan's, and some had what we will call double punching. For instance, on one time card, the employee's punch-in and punch-out time were both 10:08 p.m., but the first 10:08 p.m. was crossed out and replaced with a handwritten 5:30 p.m. Now, the prosecutor wanted to know what happened there. How could she explain that? According to Myers, what was happening was the employee forgot to punch in, and so punched the card twice while checking out, and then the manager would go and correct the start time at the end of the shift. Anyone who has worked a job with a time clock has probably experienced something similar. Also, this is consistent with other testimony by Myers and Schramm at trial. They would use a schedule to determine who was supposed to be working at the start of the shift, and then would consult the time card at the end of the shift. Point five. The Houlihan's time card covered 2-week periods. So, one side might cover the first week in February, and the other side might cover the second week in February. On some time cards, including some of Willie's cards, there would be a punch-in time that was crossed out with the words wrong side written next to it. Susan Myers testified that sometimes employees would just punch in the wrong side of the time card into the machine, and the card had to be corrected. This seems like no big deal. It's just human error. And according to Myers and Schramm, human error that they would have corrected on the very same night of that shift.
Now Next, we have point six. There was a time card for Willie that was undated. It didn't have a date on top of the time card. Prosecutor showed this time card to Susan Myers, and she testified there was a notation on the card indicating this was the time card for when Willie was a new hire. Therefore, the time card wouldn't have been made ahead of time, which explains the lack of a date on top. After this, we have point seven. There were some time cards where the date or name at the top of the time card was crossed out and replaced with a different date or a different name. As Susan Myers explained at trial, the restaurant host made the time cards and sometimes made mistakes in the date. And sometimes one employee would accidentally grab someone else's time card at the start of the two-week period and punch in. But Myers noted that both of these errors would have been noted on the first night of the new pay period and would have been corrected that night. So let's pause now at this moment. Points 1 through 7 were all attempts by the prosecution to claim that the jury couldn't trust the time card system at Houlihan's and that Willie's time card could have been a mistake or maybe even a manipulation. But here's the thing. All the prosecution showed were human errors in the time card system that, if we believe Myers and Schramm, were corrected the very same night they were created. Furthermore, the defense had Susan Myers bring in the Houlihan's paybook from the period that included January 24, 1992. That paybook showed that Willie Vesey was paid for working 56.75 hours. The number of hours on Willie Vesey's time card? 56.75 hours. For Seth Schramm, it's all pretty simple.
And the bottom line is this, Colin. I know Willie was there.
Moving back to the prosecutor's arguments, we have point eight. Maybe Willie was able to kill Jamaican while taking a break. Susan Myers shuts this whole argument down. There was no B on Willie Vesey's time card on January 24th, meaning he took no break. The prosecutor responded to this by noting that there were no Bs on any of Willie's time cards for any of the dinner shifts. And Myers responded that this made sense, because the dishwashers rarely had time to take a break during dinner shifts. The prosecutor asked about state labor laws authorizing breaks, and Myers responded that dishwashers typically took quote-unquote breaks at the start or end of their shifts, which is not legal under labor laws, but unfortunately not an uncommon occurrence.
Yeah, and so this is kind of a crappy thing to do, but I was once the cashier at a busy Wendy's during the busy lunch shift, and they did the same thing. I couldn't take a break during my actual shift, and so my break that I got under the labor laws was either at the start or end of my shift, so this is certainly not something that was uncommon.
And then there's point nine. Maybe Willie slipped out the back door in the middle of the shift and later slipped back in, totally undetected. Susan Myers accurately remembered this was a point of contention at trial.
I remember vaguely, and I could be wrong, that it was several weeks, I think, after the crime took place that he was arrested. And it just made no sense because the prosecution was saying that he had done this whole time card thing, you know, so he would have an alibi. Yet he never mentioned that he was working. You know, he never used it as an alibi. Like, it was a surprise to him when he found out that he was actually punched in and punched out that night, because he didn't, you know. The whole thing was just crazy.
And next we have point 10, which might be the most interesting. According to the record of Willie Vesey's confession and the testimony of the detectives at trial, Willie didn't mention the Houlihan's alibi during his police interrogation. At trial, the prosecution would claim that this was evidence that the alibi was fabricated, but this seems nonsensical. If Willie went to great lengths to create a fake alibi, why wouldn't he use that alibi when questioned about the murder as opposed to confessing about the crime? Isn't it likelier that Willie was innocent and had no idea about whether or not he was working on the night of January 24th when he was interrogated on June 9th? 4.5 months later? Marissa Bluestein, the director of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, had this take on the state's argument.
Yeah, remember, they didn't, according to Willie, at least in what's in the statements, they didn't tell him what night they were talking about. And so, you know, he didn't know. And like his sister said, and I think, again, this is consistent with what's in the trial testimony, he had been drinking that night, he had been out, and he was very groggy, you know, to say the least, when he gets taken in. So, you know, that he didn't remember that he was working that night is not surprising to me. He wasn't arrested the next day. This was several months later. So all that makes sense to me. But an innocent person is not going to say, oh, I was at work that night, thinking, well, maybe everybody that I work with, whether I know them well or not, will cover for me. And, you know, doctor evidence and doctor corporate records to be able to prove the fact that I was there, even though I really wasn't. So that makes absolutely no sense at all.
Are you in need of great talent for your business, but you're short on time? You don't have to get lost in a huge stack of resumes to find your perfect hire. You just need the right tools, smarter tools. With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. So you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates. Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you get the best possible matches as quickly as possible. That's why ZipRecruiter is different, because unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them. You can even get a head start on the interview process by adding screening questions to your job post and help identify the most qualified candidates, so you don't have to waste time sorting through a stack of resumes to find the perfect fit. No wonder 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site in just one day. That's right, 24 hours. And the easy-to-use ZipRecruiter dashboard lets you manage your hiring process from start to finish all in one place. So find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified candidates with immediate results. Right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And then there's Jim Tranum. As he'll tell you, he's most famous for a case in which he was the detective who secured a woman's confession to killing a man whose body was found near the Anacostia River. But that confession turned out to be a false confession, and he sees parallels between Willie's case and that case.
In my case, our person had a very valid alibi in reference to some sign-in, sign-out sheets at a homeless shelter. She did not bring those up. She didn't think to bring those up. We stumbled across them ourselves. And I think that's probably what happened here. He was, you know, confronted, you're the one who did this. We know that you did it, which is a typical interrogation tactic that's taught. There's nothing that you can say that will convince us otherwise. And he just didn't think that, well, I was at work that night, especially if they didn't tell him that he was at work that night. But according to them, and according to his confession, he had to have snuck out of work, go play basketball somewhere, and then get picked up and do all these things, and then get back to work with nobody seeing him during this time period, which I think that would be something that would concern me if I was trying to put this out there as reliable evidence.
And then there's Houlihan's manager, Susan Myers.
It was several weeks, I think, after the crime took place that he was arrested. It just made no sense because the prosecution was saying that he had done this whole time card thing, you know, so he would have an alibi, yet he never mentioned that he was working. You know, he never used it as an alibi.
And finally, here's the other Houlihan's manager, Seth Schramm.
You know, and it would take somewhat of a mastermind to manipulate leaving and coming back, killing somebody and coming back.
Well, right. And then the detectives say he didn't even bring up Houlihan's when he confessed, which, if you've gone to all the trouble to create this fake alibi, why are you confessing and not bringing this masterly crafted alibi into the discussion? So it's very strange. And his confession doesn't really match up with what any of the witnesses saw.
Yeah, oh, it is. And I could see him being forced into something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few final points by the state at trial. First, we have point 11, the termination notice. At trial, the prosecutor produced a termination notice dated May 5th, 1992 for Willie Vesey. The reason stated was, quote-unquote, job abandonment. Now, at first, it seemed like the prosecutor was trying to use this to rebut the evidence of Willie's good character, but it turns out that nothing could be further from the truth. We finally got the chance to talk to Willie, and here's how he described his hiring at Houlihan's.
I got a friend that I knew that lived in my around the corner from me, got me the job. He told me they was looking for a dishwasher, but I sort of wanted to go in for a short order cook. So I went up there and filled out the paperwork. They hired me. They said they didn't have a position open yet for short order cook, but when something opened, they'll let me know, but would I be willing to do the dishwashing? So I said, yeah, I'll take that.
So Willie took the dishwashing job, worked hard, paid his dues, and eventually he was rewarded with a promotion. At trial, Seth Stram would say that people referred to working in the dish room as working in the ghetto and working on the line as working in the suburbs. Therefore, Willie's case was a case of moving on up.
Willie started out as a dishwasher, and he was someone that I took interest in. I supervised all the staff that were considered back of the house. So it was dishwashers, cooks, assistant chefs, and all that stuff. So I worked with him on working on some food product, doing some prep, and then we gave him a position called expediter. And that job was a position that was basically working next to me, especially on busy nights, helping me make sure that every plate that was set up right went out right.
And at trial, that seemed to be the explanation for the termination notice. Not that Willie was being fired from the Houlihan's altogether, but that he was being quote-unquote terminated from his job as a dishwasher to be promoted to his job as an expediter. Either that or the termination notice, which was dated early May, was related to Willie losing his job after being arrested and incarcerated, with the date of the notice being a month off. This then leads to the way the prosecutor really used the termination notice, to try to establish that Houlihan's corporate records are unreliable, meaning that Willie's time card couldn't be trusted. But it seems like a real leap to say that a human-generated termination notice is at all similar to a machine-stamped time card. And then finally we have point 12. The prosecutor tried to claim that the Houlihan's employees acted sketchy when he was trying to get their corporate records, and that they were in effect covering for Willie because they were afraid that Houlihan's could be sued if it turned out their time cards were fake or even forged. As for what happened when the prosecutor tried to get the records, here's how Seth Stram describes what went down.
And when they came in, they didn't even identify themselves as being prosecutors. They identified themselves as being lawyers. I mean, I vaguely remember. That's what I remember. And then when they started asking questions, they were rude. I didn't really know why they were there at the time until, you know, kind of figured it out on my own. And then they were started kind of questioning our process and asked about where we stored the time cards. And et cetera, et cetera. And they can't, you know, when you're in a restaurant like that, you don't have a whole lot of time to talk to people.
Right.
I'm sure there are two sides to this story, and I think that both might have some degree of truth. The prosecutor wanted to get the restaurant's records, the employees were busy and felt like their system was being challenged, and as a result, there was some awkwardness between the two. It happens. But does that justify this argument made by the prosecutor during his closing arguments?
Defense counsel posed a question. What possible motivation or what interest could Houlihan's have in the outcome of this case? Think about it. Can Houlihan's management get up there and admit that one of their employees was not where they said he was supposed to be, but instead was somewhere else? Even if it was to do something innocent as drive a car? I'm not saying a murder, of course they can't admit to that, because that opens up the door to all kinds of liability for the corporation. If you were supposed to be working in a Houlihan's restaurant, and you left and you went and did something and somebody got hurt, you better believe Houlihan's is going to get sued. And what interest did Susan Myers and Seth Stram have in this case? They are the managers who are on duty that night. Do you really expect them to get up there and admit that they weren't watching people and watching things as closely as they say they were? They can't admit that. They'd get fired. They can't admit that. They gotta come in here and they have to toe the company line. We have procedures.
Yeah, I mean, so Susan, what are your thoughts on this argument?
That's not an argument for civil liability.
That is not at all what would happen. There's no way that Houlihan's would be found liable civilly for a murder based upon theoretically an employee gaming the system and slipping out of work or having someone else clock in and clock out. It doesn't make any sense.
Taking an unauthorized break, leaving your workplace and abandoning it to go murder someone is definitely a frolic and detour.
Right. To that point, if we're talking about civil liability, a frolic and detour from work is something that cannot be attributed back to the employer, in this case, Houlihan's. And Jim Fogorsky of the Pennsylvania Innocence Project had similar thoughts.
Jules objected to that, too. I think he got a positive ruling from the judge, and they changed it and said that there wouldn't really be liability there. And I think Gilson said something about, just theoretically. I'm just speaking theoretically or something to that effect. But he seemed to be clearly trying to pull out all the stops to show that, because he seemed to take it personally that these people were testifying that Willie couldn't have done it. And that's why he was raking them over the coals so much. That's just my impression anyway.
They just kind of like sidestep it. They don't put a lot of emphasis on an alibi. You know, they just kind of like, well, of course they would lie. They love this person. It's such a non-issue, usually, in a closing. The fact that he took it on so, dramatically, that's kind of telling.
But here's the thing. It worked. Maybe the jurors thought that the Houlihan's managers were lying. Maybe they thought that the time card was unreliable. Maybe they thought that Willie had devised a master scheme to create the perfect alibi. Or maybe the prosecution's attempts at confusing them were successful. I mean, maybe it's all the above. But let's get back to the core of the issue. The murder of the Jamaican was just before 10 p.m. on January 24th, 1992. Willie Veazey, who didn't have a car and took a bus to and from work, had a time card that showed him punching into work at 5:59 p.m. that same day, and not punching out until 1:52 or 1:54 a.m. the following morning. And for Seth Schramm, this leaves no doubt about his innocence.
I'm going to tell you, right, I've been a high school principal for 18 years. And I have measures of accountability still in life that are very detail-oriented and important. And I reflect back to this often because I believe Willie's doing life and unjustly. He was wrongfully convicted.
But despite his beliefs, Willie Veazey was convicted. It took several days of deliberations, and the jury eventually returned a second-degree murder conviction, not a first-degree murder conviction, meaning that they found this was a murder committed without premeditation. And while that verdict has been challenged a few times over the last 25 years, none of those challenges have been successful. But now, there's new evidence, a new appeal, and possibly tomorrow, November 7th, 2017, a new district attorney, who has promised to look into cases of possible wrongful convictions in Philadelphia. So, what is this new evidence, and why is there reason to believe that Willie Veazey might soon be a free man? Next time on Undisclosed. A big, big thank you to everybody who made this very important series possible. I have to begin by thanking the folks at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, Marissa, Riley, Jim. You guys do amazing work, your entire teams. Thank you to Mital Thalhan as our executive producer. Thanks for keeping us going. Baluki, thank you so much for designing our logo. A big thanks to Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez for our theme music. Thank you to all of our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Audio production is done by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media, and she is the host of one of my favorite podcasts, by the way, Crime Writers On, and a new podcast called AGTV and Me. Definitely check it out. Don't forget to send any questions you have to us over Twitter and use the hashtag UDAddendum. And don't forget to follow us online on all our social media. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.